Chapter 3. The Washington Secret. As he awoke, John noticed that the room had, at that same moment, become filled with sunlight. The panels of one wall had slid aside, leaving his chamber open to the day. A large servant in a white uniform stood beside his bed.
"Good evening," muttered John.
"Good morning, sir. Are you ready for your bath, sir? Oh, don't get up. I'll put you in. If you'll just undo the buttons on your pajamas. Like that. Thank you, sir." John lay quietly as his pajamas were removed. He was amused and delighted as he felt the bed lift up slowly on one side, and he began to roll toward the wall. When he reached the wall, it slid back, and he dropped gently into a bath filled with water the same temperature as his body. He looked around. The wall had closed back up, and he was in a different room, sitting in a bath dug into the ground with his head just above the floor. All around him, lining the walls of the room and the sides and bottoms of the bath itself, was a blue aquarium, and looking down through the clear crystal bath, he could see fish swimming past his toes. Sunlight came down through the sea-green glass ceiling above. "I suppose, sir, that you'd like hot rose water this morning, and perhaps cold salt water to finish?" said the servant standing next to him.
"Yes," agreed John, smiling.
The servant pressed a button, and a warm rain began to fall. The water turned to a pale rose color, and liquid soap shot into it from four miniature lion heads at the corners of the bath. In a moment, a dozen little paddle wheels, fixed to the sides, had mixed the water into a rainbow of pink foam, which swallowed him softly into its delicious warmth.
"Shall I turn on the moving picture machine, sir?" suggested the servant. "There's a good comedy in this machine today, or I can put in a serious piece in a moment if you prefer it."
"No, thanks," answered John politely. He was enjoying his bath too much to desire any distraction. But a distraction soon came as the sound of music as fresh, cool, and green as the room itself drifted in from just outside. After a cold saltwater finish, John stepped out and into a soft bathrobe, and on a comfortable couch, he was rubbed with oils and spices by the servant. Later, he sat in a soft chair while his hair was trimmed.
"Mr. Percy is waiting in your living room," said the servant,
when these operations were finished.
"My name is Gigsome, Mr. Unger, sir. I will look after Mr. Unger every morning."
John walked out into the bright sunshine of his living room. He found breakfast waiting for him. Percy was sitting on a couch. This is the story of the Washington family as Percy told it to John during breakfast. Percy's grandfather, Fitznorman Culpepper Washington, was from Virginia, a direct descendant of George Washington and Lord Baltimore. At the end of the Civil War, he was a 25-year-old colonel with a large farm and about $1,000 in gold. Washington decided to give the Virginia estate to his younger brother and go west. He selected two dozens of the most faithful slaves, who worshipped him, and bought 25 tickets to the west, where he intended to buy land in their names and start a sheep and cattle farm. When he had been in Montana for less than a month and things were going very badly, he made a great discovery. He had lost his way when riding in the hills, and after a day without food, he began to look around for something to eat. As he did not have his rifle with him, he was forced to chase a mouse. He did not catch the mouse, but just before it disappeared into its hole, it dropped something shiny. Bending down, Fitznorman's eye was caught by a sparkle in the grass, and in 10 seconds he had completely forgotten about his hunger and gained $100,000. The mouse had given him a large, perfect diamond. Late that night, he found his way to camp, and 12 hours later all his slaves were with him, digging furiously at the side of the mountain. He told them he had discovered a rhinestone mine, and, as only one or two of them had ever seen even a small diamond before, they believed him. He soon understood the extraordinary truth. The mountain was a solid diamond. He filled 4 bags full of diamonds and rode to St. Paul. There he could only sell half a dozen small stones. When he tried a larger one, a storekeeper fainted and Fitznorman was arrested for disturbing the peace. He escaped from jail and caught the train for New York, where he sold a few medium-sized diamonds in exchange for about $200,000 in gold. But he did not dare to sell any of the bigger diamonds, and in fact, he left New York just in time. The appearance of large diamonds in the city from mysterious sources started wild rumors that a diamond mine had been discovered in the Catskills, on the Jersey coast, on Long Island, and beneath Washington Square. Trains packed with men carrying mining equipment began to leave New York hourly, headed for various places where the diamonds were rumored to be. But by that time, young Fitznorman was on his way back to Montana. By the end of a fortnight, he had estimated that the diamond in the mountain was approximately equal to all the rest of the diamonds in the world put together, but more valuable because it was one solid diamond. If it were offered for sale, the market would collapse, and anyway, there would not be enough gold in the world to buy even a tenth of it. It was an amazing problem. He was, in one sense, the richest man that ever lived, and yet was he worth anything at all? If his secret got out, there was no knowing what the government might do to prevent panic in the market. They might confiscate the diamond immediately. So he decided that he must sell his mountain in secret and in very small pieces. He brought his younger brother and put him in charge of the servants, who still did not realize that slavery had been abolished. Fitznorman himself set out for foreign countries with $100,000 and two cases filled with rough diamonds of all sizes. He sailed for Russia in a Chinese ship, and 6 months after leaving Montana, he was in St. Petersburg. He rented a simple and out-of-the-way apartment and immediately visited the court jeweler, announcing that he had a diamond for the Tsar. He remained in St. Petersburg for 2 weeks, in constant danger of being murdered, moving from hotel to hotel, and afraid to visit his bags more than 3 or 4 times during the whole fortnight. After promising to return in a year with larger and finer stones, he was allowed to leave for India. Before he left, the court treasurers had deposited $15 million to his American bank accounts using 4 different fake identities. He returned to America in 1868, having been gone a little over 2 years. He had visited 22 countries and talked with 5 emperors, 14 kings, and 3 princes. At that time, Fitznorman estimated his own wealth at $1 billion. From 1870 until his death in 1900, the history of Fitznorman Washington was a long story of gold. There were side issues, of course. He avoided the surveys, he married a Virginian lady and had a single son, and he murdered his brother, who was a threat to his secret because of his big mouth when he drank. But very few other murders stained these happy years of progress. Just before he died, he used most of his wealth to buy rare minerals in bulk, which he deposited in banks all over the world. His son, Braddock Tarleton Washington, followed his example and converted all the wealth into the rarest of all elements, radium. When Fitznorman had been dead 3 years, his son, Braddock, decided that it was time to stop. The amount of wealth that he and his father had taken out of the mountain was beyond human understanding. So he sealed up the mine. The Washingtons had enough wealth to support themselves for decades. His one worry was the protection of his secret, which, if discovered, could ruin his wealth. This was the family among whom John T. Unger was staying. This was the story he heard in his silver-walled living room the morning after his arrival.